Good Monday, everybody, and welcome back to I Fucking Love This Movie. Today's episode is going to be quite the banger for sure. On today's episode, we're going to be talking about the 1994 cult classic Airheads. And yes, I said we're because I have a guest finally. Yeah, I think I'm pretty much done flying solo on these things for right now. Today's guest is my little brother, Jeff Wilson, who I'm going to really consider as an honorary co-host because this dude's awesome. Any of you out there listening with a podcast, want a guest, book my brother. He is amazing. And he helped me out a lot, you know, with this podcast, learning kind of like how to keep it just, you know, how to keep me focused during a podcast. Because there's a lot of times I veered off, and I do that a lot. You know, that's one flaw I've had so far, and I'm willing to work on. And he steered the ship back on course, man. So thank you, Jeff, for, you know, teaching me a thing or two how to podcast. So he was great. Great guest, honorary co-host, I should say. I had a lot of fun doing this. We had a lot of fun on Friday. Went to his house, went to his apartment, you know, listened to some tunes, checked out the Metallica streaming cast, did the podcast, went out, hung out, you know, and just had a really awesome, wonderful time. So thank you, Jeff, for the hospitality. Thank you for doing this. You're an amazing honorary co-host. And this isn't the last episode we're going to do together. I'm telling you that right now. We're in talks about the next movie we're going to do. And for those of you that, spoiler alert, for those of you that enjoy the Van Halen bit in this episode, you are really going to enjoy the next episode, because the next episode, the Van Halen connection's extremely deep. So stay tuned for that. I should really stop talking and let the podcast do the talking. So before I go, I'd like to thank all my listeners. Everybody's been digging it. Thank you so much for checking it out, and I hope you enjoy this episode. So without further ado, episode 4, Airheads. Hello, everybody. We are live on KPPX Rebel Radio, and I've got goosebumps, frankly. Why? Because I finally have a guest. Make this intro a little short. He was my first roommate. He's still my sidekick, my first sidekick, still my sidekick. Former employer, because I used to roadie for this dude and carry his heavy-ass, you know, Lars Ulrich from 1986 kid upstairs and set him up. And, you know, last thing I'll say before I introduce the guest, Tower Records ain't got nothing on this motherfucker. Like, he's just got a collection that's just unbelievable. Without further ado, my brother, Jeff Wilson. Jeff, how you doing, man?
Hey, I know you guys think I'm a real dick cheese burger or whatever. Great, dude. Great. Thanks. Wow, what an intro, dude. Listen, when you say employer, I feel like that's kind of loose. I feel like maybe you were like the world's best unpaid intern.
You
got into the gigs for free, but like,
it wasn't even that. It was just the hang. I got to learn.
And you drove most of the time. So it's like, I think I was paying, you were paying me at some point.
I remember the first gig I roadied for you guys after we became single. And I was like, great. It was at a church up near Buckeye Lake. We didn't know it was a church.
The church. Yeah. The church gig.
And we showed up. I'm like, all right, it's a lock in, you know, Hawaii.
I mean, it was cool. It was a cool gig. You know, we were kids.
But it looked innocent, but like, I'm like, all right, I'll lock in, you know, they're going to drink Hawaiian punch and eat Fig Newtons and worship God. Okay, that's cool, whatever. I remember going out to I drove dad's car because I had my truck at the time and I didn't want to drive it that far. I was so worried about it because I was like, I don't want to put miles on it. But looking back, I should have just drove everywhere. And I remember going to the dad's car because I smoked at the time. All these kids are out there drinking Boone's Farm, and I think one kid, and mind you, they're high schoolers, and one kid was just like, hey, man, can I have a cigarette? I'm like, dude, you're like six. You know. And I smoke American Spirits. I'm not giving you any of my $9 cigarettes. Get out of here. So, but yeah, that's a whole other podcast. So let's get into it. Yeah. We're going to do Airheads, but before Airheads, I have asked my guest here to give me a review of a movie. My brother sees movies and shit all the time. He's way more up to date and current with the shit that's coming out now. I'm too, I wouldn't say I'm stubborn, but like, I'm too interested in like old shit. You know, just like, I'll go see this, man. It's current. I'm like, now I'm digging fucking, you know, Lucille Fulcher right now. I can't. I'll get to it later. So you saw House of Gucci, and I want to hear.
I did, yes. So when you say I'm more current in movies, I'm not like Roger Ebert. You know, I'm not out there seeing every movie.
It's just entertainment.
It's just really just like, you know what? If it looks all right, if I like who's in it, if I like who's doing it, like whatever. It's if it's a $5 Tuesday. You know, sure, I'll be there. So I saw House of Gucci on a $5 Tuesday. Me and my girlfriend Megan went there, and I've told you before, I'm a big Adam Driver guy, big Adam Driver fan. I think he's a fantastic actor.
You watch Girls?
What?
The show Girls? Did you watch?
No.
That's where I first seen him. And
really?
I turned around.
Yeah, see, that's the thing. Is like, I got to do like a whole deep dive, but I feel like he's just such a straight-up method actor. Loved him on SNL, loved him Marriage Story, obviously Star Wars. So, like, great. Just great from top to bottom. And then, like, okay, Lady Gaga, sure, I'll give it a shot.
She's a good actress.
I'll give it a shot. All right, I'll give it a shot. And then Jared Leto is Jared Leto. So we went and saw it, you know, and, like, as I was just sitting there watching it, and, like, Lady Gaga is, like, merging her accent between Russian and Italian. Like, it just blends together a lot of the time. And honestly, the only one who's consistent throughout the whole movie is Adam Driver. And
I heard that.
Everybody, I feel like, is doing a different style Italian accent the whole movie.
What about Pacino? Like, he's
I mean, Pacino is Pacino, but he's old as shit. So, like, it's just, I mean, he's great, but, like, I mean, it's just, you know, it's nothing to shake your stick at, you know. And then Jared Leto, literally, I'm positive, was doing a straight-up Mario impersonation the whole movie. Like, straight-up played Nintendo and was like, this is it. This is Italy. And he just, that's what he did the whole movie. Just straight-up like, ah, it's a me! And I'm just like, this is what people make fun of when they go to the movies.
Did you watch that review from the Your Mom's House podcast that I sent you of them reviewing it?
No, I didn't.
Well, they fact-checked, and I guess the guy Jared Leto played was a real person.
Yeah.
But he wasn't overweight.
Yeah, I don't know where some of that stuff comes in. I mean, Ridley Scott, right? I mean, like, dude, you've got so many, like, A-plus players, and this is an A-plus director, and it was a long movie, but I thought it was entertaining. Like, I'm glad I only paid $5 for it, but, like, at the same time, damn, like, whoa.
And it's so weird because Ridley Scott released two movies. I don't know if he made them like back to back, which I've heard is just a task in itself. I don't know if he made them back to back or one of them was shelved because of the pandemic, because a lot of stuff didn't get released until after, you know, we kind of figured out where we're going with this.
Yeah.
I don't know if he did it that, but like, but it's one thing to have one movie get panned because people are tearing Last Duel apart.
Yeah, I also heard not a lot of people saw it. So the only reason I really want to see it, aside obviously from the Adam Driver aspect, was that when I went and saw, it might have been House of Gucci, but I saw another movie at the theater, and they had free Last Duel posters.
Yeah, I had to move it
so,
to
this
chair.
So I got two, and I gave one to our brother Carson, and I'm keeping one. So I feel like if I have to have the poster, I at least should see the movie maybe once. But I heard millennials aren't seeing movies because whatever, there's so the big budget. Oh, that's a whole, once again, that's a whole nother podcast we can have about that.
But the thing that killed me about both movies, they're done by Ridley Scott, and Ridley Scott's done some of the best movies ever, and he's going ape shit because, you know, people are grilling him, like, to his face.
Yeah, and I don't know, it's a weird time to be a director, especially if you've done some really amazing things in the past and still trying to reinvent yourself for the new generation. It's hard, you know.
But the thing with Ridley Scott is this shit's hit or miss. Like, really, if you really sit down and look at the movies he's done in the last 20 years, it's hit or miss. The last good Ridley Scott movie I actually enjoyed from like start to finish was American Gangster, and that was 2007. And since then, he's re-entered the Alien franchise, which is fucking weird because for years he's like, I already conquered that. Nobody can beat that. I'm like, dude, did you see Aliens? James Cameron's Aliens.
Yeah.
But the thing that killed me about House of Gucci was, like, he's so detail-oriented. Like, you watch any of his movies, and it's just like, oh, my God, you paid attention to that. And then this one, he's just like, oh, I don't care, whatever. Yeah, nice fake Italian accent, bro. Like, that's awesome.
I mean, you don't know. You honestly don't know what people are when they're behind their art. You don't know what's going on behind the scenes. So I think there's a big element. When something is not received well, I still firmly believe that there's some other story, some other side that no one ever looks at. And, like, you don't know. You don't know what kind of constraints he was under with COVID and everything. Like, you don't know. In this day and age, you really don't know what was going on. And that's just how it is. So,
and movies get made so fucking fast now. Like, literally, yeah. You're on production for 3 months. You're in post for, like, maybe 3 weeks. And then, like...
And then, boom, it hits, you know, HBO Max.
I heard that's ending. Like, they're cutting out.
Yeah, they're
doing
the whole new movie thing. Yeah, that ended already. But, I mean, the big streaming services are already, like... buying up movies. I know Netflix put up a ton of money for Knives Out 2, which is coming out later this year.
That's surprising, because the first one did really good.
It did, yeah. It was a $40 million budget, made like $300 million box office, and amazing. I mean, it's such a good film. So well done. And Netflix is like, here's $450 million. Let's see the second one. But I heard it's going to be a dual like theater and Netflix release, which is cool. But later this year, so I'm excited. It might even do the festival circuit first, which you also don't see. Big budget movies do the festival circuit before it hits the theaters. That never happens.
Because
so.
The indies, like, you know, A24, Spectrevision, and all that, like the Nicolas Cage movies, they conquer that shit. Yeah. They're like, this is our movie. And it's also weird, back to the streaming thing, you know, they're doing Scorsese movies. I mean, here's a guy that could literally throw a fucking knife and get a major distribution from a studio now, you know.
Maybe. You know, and you think about it, I mean, it's a generational thing. People who were putting up big money in the studios for big time directors like Scorsese, they're not in power anymore. Now people who are in charge of making those decisions are younger people who are like, you know what? We don't know who this guy is as much as the other guy.
Good fella.
Yeah, we're past, he might be past his prime. We're looking for the next big thing. And maybe Scorsese is turning to dust anytime soon, so we can't really we can't take a risk like that anymore. I think it's all a big, like, it's who you know, obviously, but I mean, the pages are turning, so
I'm waiting for Spielberg to have to do a fucking streaming movie, because he dogs
it'll happen. Especially after West Side Story, it's definitely gonna happen.
Yeah, our little brother saw West Side Story and just was like, what was that? I was like, did you see the original one? He's like, do I need to? I'm like,
I mean,
but that was a passion project for Spielberg. Like, he grew up loving, you know, West Side Story, Lawrence of Arabia and stuff, and like, he makes movies to entertain.
What's the last big Spielberg film?
God.
You can't say the new Indiana Jones.
I want, like, big has
Schindler's List?
No, but I do have a funny, it's not really a funny story, but he got criticized for that movie because, you know, it was about the Holocaust, and he was like, oh, you're making a big budget movie about the fucking Holocaust, and you're going to make all this money. Truth is, he didn't take any money for it, and he didn't take a percentage of the gross. It's a wonderful film. It's a sad film.
Yeah. But it was Seriously, the last big Spielberg film, Schindler's List?
No. I want to say Ready Player One.
All right, I guess. But, like, once again, based purely on nostalgia. You know what I mean? Like, that's what it is.
But,
so.
But that's the weird shift with Spielberg. He'll do these, like, History Channel movies, as I call them, because they'll pick an event and then make a movie about
it. I'm talking like huge, like Jurassic Park huge.
He's not in the business for that anymore.
Exactly.
Really,
that's what I'm saying. Really, so like West Side Story, I mean, what are you looking to get out of it? You're looking for a hit, or you're looking just for whatever?
That was just a passion project. You love that movie. But real quick about the Schindler's List one, I looked at a quote, and Terry Gilliam, who did Brazil and Time Bandits, he was in a Monty Python. Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, he did that. And then the last Heath Ledger movie that they had, I think it was Jude Law and Johnny Depp play his character too. He was talking about it, and he pretty much was like, you know, Steven, the Holocaust was not a success the way you portrayed it to be. And I'm sitting there, I'm like, it was a human story. Like, the, you know, Oscar Schindler, and, you know, he saved all these people's lives. He wanted to tell that story. Did you even watch the movie? Like,
yeah.
So...
All I know is that I feel like people haven't been excited about a Spielberg flick since, and that was 20 years ago. So, but, like, I'm just saying, this new generation of moviegoers and movie fans, they want weird, they want, you know, something that's new, they want something kind of fresh, but also, like, I just feel like Spielberg, I don't want to say past his prime, but, like, he doesn't need to do movies like that anymore. He doesn't need new movies at all, like, unless it's, like, something totally that's going to totally bust open the market. So, but whatever, dude. We're not here to fucking talk about Spielberg.
Yeah, I'd like to rampage, and I'm learning a lot here. Well, not rampage, like rant. I'm learning a lot having a guest here. So we're here. Actually, before we go, real quick, we lost two legends today. We lost Meatloaf.
Yeah, we do need to.
And we lost Louis Anderson. Yeah. Meatloaf, you know, Jeff's a huge Meatloaf fan. I mean, he makes good music. I know him more from the fucking movies than anything. I mean,
yeah. Rocky. I just honestly feel like, I mean, everybody knows Rocky Horror at this point. I mean, this is a timeless classic, and Meatloaf was timeless in that film. And
can't forget Wayne's World, his little cameo.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. You know, so like, Fight Club. Like I said,
oh god,
he was in The Pick of Destiny, Tenacious D.
That's right.
Yeah,
he was.
Yeah, yeah. People forget about that too. So like, the dude was a born performer, was a born entertainer, and 74 years old, and was still recording an album, I'm pretty sure. So it's crazy, man. It's crazy. Yeah, Meatloaf, dude. Really sad. Really sad day. Louis Anderson, I mean.
Life with Louis. Which was an awesome show, because that was the first time like a show was about a kid, and the kid didn't look like one of the kids from Rocket Power.
Yeah. You can't say enough about him. So rest in peace.
Rest in peace.
We'll do a cheers. We have cans here of water and
liquid death.
So,
all right.
Cheers to those legends, man.
So the film we're talking about is a beloved childhood classic, if you haven't guessed from the intro, and it's the movie 1994 cult classic Airheads. And I'm holding my original VHS copy I have had for over 20 years that I bought at Hollywood Video in Mill Run. Did we see this one in the theater?
Absolutely not.
Are you sure? Mom was super liberal with us.
Absolutely not. I was three. Two.
I remember when it came out, though.
No, we did not. So I guess, you know, looking at, I mean, Airheads to me was the movie that you borrowed from Andy on VHS, or it was the movie that was always on Comedy Central.
Oh, yeah. Comedy Central.
That you would watch during the day if you were home from school, which never happened. But if you were, and you know, during the summer it was always on, you always watched it. You always watched it. And anyone that has ever acknowledged Airheads publicly to me, I always want to sit down and have a chat with them, because this movie is so good.
It flows really well.
It really is a time capsule into what the music scene was back in the you know, early to mid 90s.
It definitely reflected of how things used to be. I mean, you got a band together, you played, you like struggled during the club scene, and then you recorded a demo and you hope that demo got played.
Yeah.
And it's not like that anymore.
It was insanely accurate for the time, and like, and I have always said this too, like the dialogue in that movie alone is one of the most,
it's authentic.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's so unique, it's so out there. And like, the thing is like, Steve Buscemi, Adam Sandler, and Brendan Fraser look like a band. Like they look like they're a real band. Like they pulled, it's not like Colin Farrell in a wig, you know what I mean? Like, this is like an actual band.
Or Marky Mark in a wig?
Yeah, these are real people that you could believe in 1994 were in a band that could rock out. And like I said, I mean, and even the supporting cast is even so good. Michael McKean.
And that's funny, because like, did they cast him because he was in Spinal Tap and he's playing a complete opposite
from
the character?
Honestly,
from
I thought about that too, but like, even him as, you know, the yuppie, you know, is so, it's perfect, you know? And like I said, the dialogue, everything about it is so unique for the time, and it's so perfect. I don't know if I know another movie that's as quotable with the dialogue, like the world's best insults.
Getting a truck, dingus.
Yeah, it's exactly. Like, you know, like, I just really, like I said, it's a total period piece. It's a total time capsule for what the time was. Like, the look, everything about it. And
yeah, like, I remember 1994. Like, and I was like, yeah, I knew rocker dudes that look like that.
Anytime that you really want to look at rock and roll, what the music scene was like, and, you know, Marky Mark, that guy sucks. You know what I mean? Like, this dude, that's great.
But it's funny, though, because, like, more movies got, not too many, but they got made, and they aren't as authentic. Like, Rockstar, I mean, I like it, but do you honestly believe, like, Marky Mark is a metal dude?
I like that movie, too, just because, I mean, for the story, and I know that they went, you know, and honestly, all the music cameos in that movie made that movie legit to me. Zach Wilde, you know.
Jeff Pilson. You can't forget Jeff Pilson.
Jeff Pilson, yeah. Rocking with Dokken, dude. Yeah, how do you forget that? But like, Airheads, dude, had a level of legitimacy to it, because like I said, it was believable. Like, this is a band I would go see. I would totally go see this band live.
And when you listen to the degenerated song, which is a Reagan Youth cover, by the way, you honestly believe they were playing it. Yeah. Like, I think Brendan Fraser singing it.
He did, yeah.
He actually sang it?
Well, like in the music version.
Oh, I thought he actually sang it, like on the recording of it.
Yeah, I think there is a version that they did with Brendan Fraser's vocals, isn't there?
Why don't they release that?
Yeah, exactly. Because I feel like once, like at the very end when they're playing the song, I feel like that's his vocals. But like, dude, I mean, it's just it's an endless slew of great people who are in this movie. Michael Richards at the very height of Seinfeld.
Was Seinfeld big at that point?
Huge. Huge at that point. I mean, they were talking like season 4, season 5 of Seinfeld right then and there. Like, that is it's like peak Seinfeld popularity.
It was, because I heard it took a while for people to actually catch on to it.
Yeah, Seinfeld, I mean, started in 89. So, like, at that point, it was like, yeah, this is the show that's to watch. And Michael Richards being literally Kramer with a mustache.
But, like, subtle.
I don't have a home. I have a condo. Like, yeah, and just being a goofy weirdo. Like, I don't know. I think everybody in the world needs to watch this movie because it's honestly fantastic. I mean, Chris Farley.
That was, I think, one of the first Chris
Hudson.
One of the first Chris Farley movies. It was the first movie Steve Buscemi and Adam Sandler did. And it's, what, 20? It's 20-some years late, 27 years later, 26 years, 28 maybe, and they're still doing movies together.
Yeah.
And Brendan Fraser, man's getting this resurgence that I'm absolutely loving.
Yeah, the Fraser Renaissance is upon us, and I might have to say, I mean, besides Encino Man, this is my favorite Brendan Fraser flick. I mean, you got to put The Mummy up there, but like...
He did another movie we really like. I mean, Encino Man, Airheads, Mummy. What was the other one? We'll think of it at some point. I liked him in Bedazzled.
Bedazzled. And then what was the one where he was like a kid? Chris loves this movie, where he's like that guy stuck in the house. His parents keep him in the house forever.
What was it, Monkey Bone?
Maybe that was it.
I just remember that. And then it was funny because I watched the videotape before we did this, and they had trailers.
Yeah.
And they had one for The Scout that had Albert Brooks in it.
Really?
He played the baseball player in Mexico that had he could throw, and that was on there. Some movie called
That's right. I forgot he was in that. Yeah,
and then they had some movie about a guy who got lost with his dad on a boating trip, and he only had his dog. And what else? There was one other one, but whatever. But
Surf Ninjas or some shit.
It was called Far From Home or something. It had the kid. Yeah. It had one of the hackers from Hackers in it, and it had the guy from Swim Fan. I don't know his name, but he was in it. But speaking of the cast. You know, we throw a lot of fan theories on the show, and I have one, and you are more than welcome to disagree with me. So Judd Nelson's in this movie.
Yeah.
Plays Jimmy Wang.
Once again, supporting cast is amazing.
So he plays Jimmy Wang. He's the slick record exec guy. Hear me out on this one. I have a feeling that this is John Bender.
Oh, when he's grown up.
He's grown up. He's
no
changed
way.
He changed his name. And the wing came from his love for Hendrix. As a member in the Breakfast Club, he was humming. No, it was Sunshine of Your Love. I thought it was a Hendrix tune. God, I'm slipping in my old age. But yeah, I thought of that. I was like, dude, this is Bender.
Yeah.
I wanted to say it was his character from St. Elmo's Fire, but we all know that motherfucker became a congressman or something.
Yeah.
So I was like, dude, this is Bender. He quit high school, went out to L.A. and
super duper.
And he just became lame, I guess.
Yeah. Interesting. That's interesting. That's an interesting fan theory. Honestly, I never even thought about that. I love Judd Nelson, too. Like, I'll go to bat for him, same as I will Brendan Fraser.
He's still got good bones.
Like, the guy is just, I mean, once again, like a timeless actor. This is an era of acting that you really can't recreate now. You either have it or you don't. And
he needs to do more movies. Anthony Michael Hall, too. Like, those guys.
These guys don't have to. I mean, really. They just do it because they want. I mean, but yeah, I mean, I thought he was great in this movie. I mean.
But I was going somewhere with Judd Nelson. But yeah, Judd Nelson. Like, yeah, that was another film theory that I was tossed around. Remember Eric Stoltz in Fast Times at Ridgemont High? I didn't come up with this. The guy who did Roper from Ebert and Roper came up with this. He's like, I got one for you guys. Spicoli's friend in Fast Times at Ridgemont High ended up becoming the drug dealer in Pulp Fiction.
Wow.
I mean.
Yeah, Tarantino can make anything happen, so I'm sure that's probably legit.
But so the cast.
Either way, cast is great. Like I said, fantastic.
Oh, we can't forget Joe Mantegna.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, he does. I feel like he's everywhere.
Every time I watch Criminal Minds, I'm like,
Literally, that's when I'm like, yeah, that's Ian the Shark. Every time it comes on, I'm like, dude, I think the first time I remember recognizing him on TV, I was like, yeah, that's Ian the Shark from Airheads.
Ian the Shark.
And once again, like, if you threw this premise out to these like big names back then, it's like, this is dog shit. I would never like want to be involved in this movie. But
it was one of the first movies Farley and Sandler did outside SNL. And it's funny because you watch this movie and to other people, it's like, well, this is not a great movie. But like Adam Sandler ended up blowing up after this movie theatrically with Billy Madison, Happy Gilmore. Chris Farley, too, with Tommy Boy and Black Sheep and all that other stuff.
I mean, Steve Buscemi has a long-lasting career.
Steve Buscemi's interesting because he'll do like the big budget like corporate studio movie. And then he'll turn around and do something like Fargo.
Yeah.
So you got to appreciate the Buscemi. Sandler's like that too. He'll do like the Netflix movie, goofy ass Netflix movie, and then he'll turn around and do Uncut Gems.
Yeah.
So,
but I mean, you know, basically, like I said, this like these three dudes, the most believable band.
It is like one of the few.
And I mean, like I the music's great, the vibe is great, the outfits. I mean, everybody's wearing things that are period accurate. Like,
dude, it was
this
yeah,
only the
scary.
Movie that you could have made in that time. If somebody tried to remake this movie, either for this time or trying to somehow remake it for 1994, it would not even be close. Like, I feel like this is only a movie you could have made in 93, 94 that would be the same as it was, because after that, I mean, you just don't have that authenticity.
You don't, and I don't think we saw an authentic, like, on-screen band until Almost Famous came out.
Yeah.
In 2000. Yeah, it was 2000.
It was 2000, yeah.
I remember seeing that one. The one thing I do get, and it's they're in the movie, they're part of the cast. The one thing I do get, people watch, they're like, yeah, I watched Airheads the other day, I thought of you. I was like, really? Anything pop out that reminded you of me? And they're like, oh, and White Zombie plays. I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah, let's talk about that scene for a second. The club scene. Chris Farley has to go track down Brendan Fraser's girlfriend, who's played by, I don't even know her name.
Her name's Amy Locane, and she was a pretty big hitter back in the early 90s. She's in prison right now.
What? I didn't know that.
Oh, dude, it's a fucked up story. Well,
she was a straight-up knockout, dude. Like,
she did... I forget what the first movie, one of her first movies was called Lost Angels, and it had one of the Beastie Boys in it. It was an independent film. And then she did Crybaby with John Waters, directed it, and Johnny Depp was in it.
Yeah.
And then I think she did School Ties, which Brendan Fraser's in.
Yeah.
Then she did
this, I've got that movie.
Oh, I've never seen it. Yeah. And then she did Airheads, and then she ended up on Melrose Place, and I guess she got written out of the TV show. She got replaced. Well, her acting, like, her role started to dry up, so she moved back to Jersey. That's where she's from. And, you know, she got married, had a couple of kids, and was very involved in the theater out there. Well, she did one play, and they were having a cast party, and she got drunk. Her husband's like, I'm going to take the kids home. I'll see you in a little bit. Well, she left the party, and when she was driving, she hit another car. And she drove home, and she killed, it was a husband and wife. She killed
the
wife.
Fuck, dude.
True story. Google it. And she ended up in prison for a little bit, but she got out. She got charged with vehicular manslaughter and driving drunk. She got out and she was out for a little bit, you know, did the AA thing and then went to schools and told everybody about her story and stuff. Really kind of tried to make a difference. Wow. And then she just got recently put back in prison.
No way.
Because the judge. They had a new judge. He looked at the case. He's like, you killed somebody. You only spent 2 years in jail. That's horseshit. I'm putting you back. So she's still in prison right now. It's yeah.
Wow.
But yeah, she was pretty, she was the big thing for a minute.
Damn.
Had a promising career and it just, and you know, she fucked up and you know, her life, it is what it is now and whatnot. But so
wow,
back
dude,
to the.
I had no idea. I mean, this is also kind of calls back to one of the jokes in this movie about Vince Neil. And
yeah, I didn't even think of that.
Yeah, Vince Neil. I mean, in the movie, they're talking about, hey, rock stars don't go to jail. Vince Neil only did 30 days and he killed somebody.
Oh, yeah.
And he did. He totally killed that guy from Handle the Rocks. And then there you go. And then later on in life, you know.
Had that movie been made like now and that,
wow.
that joke been told now? You know, Motley Crue would have paid an ungodly amount of money to have him remove it.
Yeah.
But back to the club scene, it was funny because I did a little research on this film, and unfortunately, there's no, like, there's not a whole lot of, like, facts and tidbits, but one of the ones that did come out of the movie was made was the bands. They were going to have Cannibal Corpse, and then the producers saw Ace Ventura.
Oh, yeah, I can't do it.
And they're like, they were going to think.
I didn't know that. That's crazy.
Then Exodus and Testament were there too, which is weird. I'm like, that they wouldn't have meshed well. No offense to those bands. And then they asked Metallica. Metallica's like, no.
Yeah, this is like Metallica's height.
It was like, it was 94.
I mean, they're huge now, but like 93, still coming off the Black Album. Like, they're a massive band. No way they would ever do like a budget, like not low budget, but like, you know, no way they would do a movie
like a goofy comedy.
And like a, yeah, and like a club. Like, that wouldn't happen.
It was, they were at the Whiskey, which Metallica started in.
Yeah.
And then, what was it? Oh, I pushed the mic away from my face. And then, it's funny, they ended up getting White Zombie. They were fucking huge.
Yeah.
Astro Creep had not, was almost had a year until that came out. And, it's funny because John Tempesta, who was either in Exodus or Testament at the time, ended up joining White Zombie a little bit later on. And yeah, I just thought that was weird. I was, because they actually mentioned that in the fact. They're like, well, the drummer, I forget which band he was in at the time, because he was in both bands. He actually went back with Exodus because the drummer had cancer. And I just thought that was a weird parallel. John Tempesta ended up joining White Zombie and ended up finishing White Zombie because Rob broke up the band 4 years later.
Yeah.
But yeah, that scene's always crazy. And like, their shows are that, well, Rob's show's kind of a little tamed down. He's video screen and stuff. But from what I've heard from people who actually seen White Zombie,
it looked like once again, like the legitimacy, it looked like a legitimate, like, rock club. Like, this is what the Whiskey looks like when somebody good is playing.
And yeah, they,
the Sons of Thunder, for Christ's sake. Are you kidding me?
You know who that was? That was the Galactic Cowboys.
Yeah.
I can't,
like, fucking like Jackal or something, like up there. Like,
this movie would,
this thing on.
And it's a funny, and speaking of that song, they were going to put it on the soundtrack, but in between it getting recorded.
So that's their song, right? Galactic Cowboys. That's their song that they were playing.
It is, but it's the Sons of Thunder, for Christ's sake. They, in between recording it and then putting the soundtrack together, the tape got lost.
Really?
So the quarter inch, 2 inch, whatever they recorded on back,
like, it actually, like, it's almost just, it's, in Airheads, when they can't play the reel to reel because
another weird parallel. Yeah, it got lost, and everybody's like, "When are you gonna put that Airheads song on?" They're like, "I don't
know where it's at."
It probably got burned up in the Universal fire with all the other shit.
Yeah,
it's probably where it was at, or it's probably in some guy's basement, or it's probably,
I got it.
Or like, remember the Anvil documentary?
Yeah.
When they should be like, oh, yeah, here's our master tapes.
Yeah, they're just laying around
in
the box.
A closet.
Yeah.
But, yeah, that's another.
Wow, I didn't think about that. That's crazy. But, and I mean, like, this funny thing is that song, I mean, Feed the Gods, it turned out to be one of my favorite White Zombie songs.
Are you even a White Zombie fan? Like,
not really. Like, I've dove in a little bit, but, like, even then, just because of that movie, I remember watching, I'm like, yeah, this song's badass. So, like, I was out at a bar a little bit ago, and you know I'm at the bar when you hear, like, Dawkins or some lame shit playing on the Touch Tunes, because that's what I do. I go and take over the Touch Tunes and annoy people with kick-ass shit. So I'm there, and I played something relatively heavy, because I think we were at Lido's, and Lido's is kind of a heavier bar. Like,
I went there once, but I'm not going to talk about what happened.
No, dude,
there.
It kind of sucks, dude. Maybe, I mean,
it's a sports bar.
Whatever.
Bros.
I mean, but it's just like, whatever. So I took over the Touch Tunes, played something relatively heavy, and somebody else took over and played a deep cut White Zombie song, and I don't remember what it was. It might have been Astro Creep.
Oh, Electric Head Part 2.
It might have been that. And so I heard that. I'm like, okay, dude wants to dance. Let's go. So I got on and played Feed the Gods, because who else in the bar is going to play Feed the Gods except if you know anything about White Zombie or Rob Zombie, or like if you're a super fan, obviously, but like not many people. I play the song and I look around. I'm like, somebody is going to be looking to whoever played the song, and it was me, and I never found the guy. But like, once again, that's my go-to. If I'm playing White Zombie, obviously you don't play Thunderkiss because you're a poser. You put on Feed the Gods, and that song kicks ass. And once again, he's in the fucking club, and it's jumping, and the lights are going, and they're up there jamming, and it's, like I said, it's a total believable scenario, and it's totally great. and he rips the guy's nipple ring off.
Oh, God.
And like I said, dude, it's all believable. That's the thing, is that there's nothing not believable about that scene, which is hard to do in movies because, I mean, it's fucking fake, all of it.
I've talked to people who had the pleasure of seeing White Zombie, and they've seen the movie, and I was like, how accurate? They're like, dude.
Yeah,
you have no idea. He's like, I saw him open for Pantera at Hair Arena. I'm like, fuck you. Just stop talking.
It's probably jumping just like that. And I just remember earlier when the Sons of Thunder were playing in the movie, and Brendan Fraser, he's got a beer. You know, they're talking, like, watching his bands. Like, didn't we blow the guys up at the Whale last month? Like, you know.
The Wheel Whale?
Yeah, the Wheel Whale. And Brendan Fraser's like, totally not dogging on him. He's like, no, man, they got an album coming out, they got their song on the radio, that's what we got to do. He almost sounds kind of drunk when he's like talking about it. He's sipping the beer. He's like, no, these guys got an album out, they got their song on the radio, that's what we got to do. And I can't tell you how many times I've been out with my band members seeing another band. I'm like, dude, we got to do that, you know? Like, you get a couple drinks and you're like, no, man, that's, we got to do that shit, that's what we got to do, you know? Like, that, once again, like, the accuracy of it being total real life is beyond any other film that I've ever seen.
And Jeff is in a band called Tacus. They're on Bandcamp, and you guys are in the middle of recording your debut.
I would like to think we're over the middle, but, you know, you don't know.
Jeff and I collect bootlegs, and I got probably my favorite. He gave me a live rehearsal they just recorded. And it's funny because they're a part of the thrash crossover hardcore punk scene. And the one thing I noticed is what you were saying. Everybody's so supportive and cheerful and like, right on, man. Because there were several bands I remember you guys still play, but
yeah,
when I go to show, there were several bands from like around that scene that were like, oh, we had a free night and we knew you guys were playing and we showed up because we love your stuff so much. That kind of camaraderie doesn't, I mean, you were kind of in that hard rock mainstream, you know, the Aros and stuff. You didn't fucking have that. Like, you had it with a few bands, but it was cutthroat, dude. I remember, like, people getting off the stage, like, yeah, you guys are great, and they were dogging you, like, 2 minutes later. But with Tacus and stuff, you guys get off stage, you're like, fuck, man, that album.
The scene is very adult, and it's like, at this point, with how it is in Columbus, especially, I mean, if somebody's out there trying to play really heavy, cool stuff and doing their own thing and rehearsing, and it's like, how do you not throw your support behind that? And it might not be music that you're into, but like, you're a Columbus native, like, you're in our hometown, like, you're here with us hanging out trying to grow the heavy scene. Like, let's party, dude. Let's have a good time.
And that's all the scene that you're a part of is about. Let's have a good time, let's cheer each other on, let's get weird and talk about Tom Waits or whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it's not cutthroat. And that's one of the refreshing things I remember when I went from Rodian with Planet Nine and Maniac for Hire to doing Tacus stuff. It's just like how just open and just great that community is. And
yeah, you know, it's nice, dude. It's refreshing. And like I said, it's not so like elbow to elbow, like everyone's trying to claw ahead anymore. And I feel like it's just, yeah, it's all about support.
And you go on stage wearing a fucking Def Leppard t-shirt and we're like, hey, man, right on.
Yeah, and that never used to happen.
Oh, dude.
So,
or you play Sunshine of Your Love and you get some old drunk like, he ain't fucking Ginger Baker, fuck that kid. I was like, yeah. But let's talk about the soundtrack we were talking about.
Yeah. I think I might actually have the soundtrack. I'm going to go see if I have it real quick.
Okay.
Go ahead and entice the listeners.
I will. So we're going to take a brief pause. Jeff's going to find the soundtrack and his archive. Like I said, Tower Records ain't got nothing on this motherfucker, I'm telling you. So, I hope you're digging this. It's a new change of pace. It's awesome. I act like Garth Algar when I do it by myself. Like, I'm having fun. Everything's fine, so this is good. This is good. I'm learning a lot. And when you do stuff like this and, you know, you're new at it and you want to get better at it, it's good to take notes. I'm taking mental notes and totally improvised. You know, it's great to have somebody on the podcast that, you know, can level with you on this kind of material. And, yeah, so I'm enjoying this. I'm digging this. I'm having fun. Friday night, I ain't got to work this weekend, and it's I actually have it.
I do not have the soundtrack. You have it with you?
I have it in the car, but I know that track listing like the back of my hand.
Okay, that's fine. That's good. I really thought I had it, dude.
I thought you did, too.
Yeah.
How do you not have
that? I mean, it's hard. I mean, that's not an easy one to track down. A lot of soundtracks are like Titanic, Lion King. Those are like...
So the first track...
A dozen.
The first track, and the soundtrack flows really good. The first song on the soundtrack is a great... It's just a banger. It's called It's a Motorhead, Whitfield Crane, and Ice-T, Born to Raise Hell. And this is actually the first time I ever heard Motorhead was on this movie. So, I mean, this movie's so important to us, but...
Yeah, me too, actually.
Yeah. I didn't really get into Motorhead until Metallica did Garage Inc. And that last part on the second disc was the Motorhead covers that they did.
Overkill, yeah.
I'm a little upset that they didn't have a Motorhead playing in the movie.
Yeah, so actually, I mean, I've wanted to cover this song forever. I mean, every band I've ever been in, I'm like, we got to play this song. Because this song fucking kicks ass, dude.
And you can get, like, vocal...
This is another, like, bar touch tune song that I've played.
And you can get guys that are in bands to take over Whitfield Crane and Ice-T.
Yeah.
And this is the first time I ever heard Ice-T, too.
Yeah.
Like, this is years before I bought the first Body Count record. I've been like, nobody talks about how heavy and great this album is.
Yeah, exactly.
Because metal at that point when that album was released was kind of underground. You know, we didn't get the new metal shit for years. And, you know, Metallica became a hard rock band, which is, you know, it's cool. And then, you know, Anthrax, as far as the big four is concerned, Anthrax kind of went kind of alternative. Megadeth just became more feasible in my eyes. Like, they could be played on the radio. And Slayer's, like, the AC/DC of the big four. They've never fucking changed. But, yeah, that track is so important. It's such a fucking banger, too, man. Like, having Whitfield Crane from Ugly Kid Joe and Ice-T on that, man. That's just such a banger. Yes.
Great song. I mean, it's a great opener to the movie, too. It's a great, it's straight up, like, I mean, this is it. This is the first thing you see. This is the first thing you hear. Awesome. Just a great intro to anything, really. I mean, that could, yeah, I love it.
And then the next track is Four Non Blondes' cover of I'm the One, the Van Halen song.
Yeah, oh my God.
That's a deep cut, man. And
like I said, if you're a new Van Halen fan in 94, you've never heard that song before. Because once again, that's a deep cut. That's probably the first time I heard that song. You know? I mean,
yeah.
And then you go back and you listen to the first Van Halen record, and you're like, oh my God, that's the song that they covered in Airheads.
For me, the one thing I love about the first Van Halen record, and we're huge Van Halen nerds, we need to do a Van Halen podcast. Actually, we need to do the Wildlife. What was I going with that? But like the best songs for me off that first Van Halen album, because radio plays that album to death. Like,
yeah, or the deep cuts.
Or the deep cut. Like, yeah. I'm the One.
Fear Love Tonight.
Atomic Punk, On Fire, Ice Cream Man. I mean, Little Dreamer.
Little Dreamer.
Jamie's Crying is kind of a deep cut, kind of.
I hear that on the radio a lot, actually.
The only ones I hear off the album a lot are Running with the Devil.
Eruption, even. They play Eruption and then You Really Got Me back to back a lot. Ain't Talking About Love. They play Ice Cream Man, too. That one's not so much of a deep cut anymore. But, like, yeah, the deep, deep ones, you know, I'm the One, Fear Your Love Tonight, Atomic Punk, Little Dreamer. Like, that's solid.
We saw them on their last tour. That was unfortunately their last tour because, you know, King Edward's sadly no longer with us. Do you think they did quite a bit of deep cuts on that one? I thought they did.
Yeah, I mean, Eddie and the whole band, they could get up there and literally fucking, they could play, I don't know. Anything they do is amazing. And they can go up there and play the greatest hits. I'd be happy. They go up there and play a list of songs they never played before. They go up there and play the Gene Simmons demo. I don't care what they do. You know, like, it's all going to be great. And I trust Eddie's judgment and what sounds good and what's going to sound good live for a live audience more than anybody else. I mean, he knows.
The one that got me, I about cried, was when they fucking played Little Guitars. Oh, yeah, my
never
God.
Never heard that one live.
But Wolfie kind of spilt that one, like, spoiler alert, because they were rehearsing and I guess Eddie's company made them Little Guitars. I was like, you guys are gonna fucking play Little Guitars? You guys haven't played that in 40 years.
Easily. But anyway.
Yeah.
Soundtrack. Yeah. We got the Van Halen cover. What's after that one?
What is after that one? There's a bunch of stuff that, like, wasn't
isn't,
in.
Isn't, We Want the Air Raves. Is that on the soundtrack?
Yeah. That's
Ramones?
Would that be considered a deep cut from the Ramones, or is anything a deep cut from the Ramones except from Blitzkrieg Bop?
I think there's, I mean, there's songs that people should know if you know anything about punk rock and Ramones, whatever. But like Pet Sematary is a big hit. But I think We Want the Airwaves is the big one there. And then
Anthrax did a cover of a Morrissey song on it. It was called London.
Yeah,
and the Morrissey one is. No, it was the Smiths, and of course, you know, Morrissey was in that band.
Yeah,
yeah, they did that one. Anthrax can do good covers though. Like, they can literally, like, They used to do this as B-sides back in the day. They did the Cowboy song from Thin Lizzy. Yeah. Their Kiss covers. I know you're particular.
No, I mean,
Kiss
they're awesome.
Covers. Their cover of Parasite. Ooh. They did Watching You Too, and they did Love Her All I Can. What else is on that? Primus song's on it. I have no idea. It's called Bastard Jail Killed or some shit.
Okay. I got the...
He's got the track list.
I went and looked it up.
More prepared
to me. Feed the Gods is obviously on it by White Zombie. No Way Out by D-Generation.
Dad saw D-Generation open for Kiss, and he's like, really?
Yeah. Can't Give In by Candlebox.
That's right. They are on it.
That's a good one. Yeah. Prong. Prong is on this damn soundtrack. Obviously, Degenerated.
Which is a Reagan Youth cover. Have you heard the original one?
The one on the soundtrack is by the Lone Rangers. So that's your Brendan Fraser cut.
But
on the soundtrack.
Here's the thing. Okay, we're going to safely assume Brendan Fraser sings that one. But Jay from White Zombie plays guitar. Sean from White Zombie plays bass. I don't know who the fucking drummer is. I don't think they got the guy who was in White Zombie at the time, because I think he got fired right after that movie came out, because I guess he was in a drugs war. But he actually passed away some years back.
Wow. And the last track to close it out is We Want the Airwaves by the Ramones.
And it ends the movie. It's the credits.
Yeah, exactly. So awesome, dude. Awesome soundtrack. I love it. Like I said, it also introduces you up to a bunch of music that you might not have been exposed to before.
Very appropriate for the times, too.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I mean, obviously, like, heavy metal had taken a hit right after the 80s with, you know, grunge coming back. I feel like this was just, like, the rise again of, like, true, like, rock and roll. Like, grunge is whatever, but, like, I feel like right now, like, 93, 94, like, rock and roll was still, like, alive and, like, on the way up.
And then, as you know, like, 94, new metal hit, and it had a nice long until the 2000, yeah. And then people were like, okay, we're tired of this Limp Bizkit shit, and, like, we want our metal bands back. So, yeah. Like, there was a big resurgence in metal at that point.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, of course, you had the heavy hitters like Priest and Maiden at 93, 94. They had different lead singers, and they weren't like the only band I can honestly say that was carrying that flag. I mean, aside from Motorhead, was Pantera.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with that 100%.
And Pantera did a tour with White Zombie, and my wife's uncle all the time is like, yeah, I was at that show. I was like, yeah, rub it in. I was like, I was six, and my dad wasn't going to go take me to go see the Pantera and White Zombie. Somebody, I think Crowbar opened that one. I don't remember. If you were there, please tell me who opened for them on that tour. So, yeah, solid soundtrack. And the movie, too. Back to the movie. It flows really well.
Yeah, great pacing. I mean,
there's no dead. And comedies are good for that. Like, if you have a good comedy on your hands, it flows really good. And the subplots and the foreshadowing, like the gun, like they found out it was fake. And then, you know, Michael Richards has that, like, assault rifle and they somehow get a real gun. And funny story, I was thinking about this on the way here. You know how he Rex, the Steve Buscemi's character, works at a toy store and gets those guns? That was actually partially real. I was watching a thing on YouTube about banned toys, and it was a set like that. They look like real, like, assault rifles. They were painted black, and they took them off the market because they looked too real. It was just like his character said.
Yeah.
And that was genius, and they filled it up with hot sauce, and they ended up getting a real gun. I was like, man, that's clever.
Yeah. And one of the things I loved, I mean, once again, going back to the legitimacy and authenticity of this movie, even trying to capture little things around the set, like, obviously inside the actual radio station, you could probably pinpoint a bunch of things that were, you know, period specific or looking really good about that stuff. But one thing that I loved also was if you look inside the van when they're driving their own van.
All the stickers,
yeah. Remember seeing a Def Leppard sticker in there? There was a bunch of bands that are really awesome.
Obituary was in there?
Obituary, yeah. It's like, you don't see this in Hollywood, in mainstream Hollywood, definitely.
I check out set design sometimes, especially like in a teenager's room and the posters they have. Yeah. And they have like... Small Soldiers comes to mind.
The kid, Led Zeppelin, yeah.
Well, Kirsten Dunst's character had that, but the boy in it, he had a Power Man 5000 poster.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that, like, record companies made deals, like, look, we'll pay.
Yeah, throw our band in there and throw a poster up. Also, like, how much money did they pay Led Zeppelin to get that song in that movie?
Dude, Led Zeppelin's one of the few people that will not license their stuff out. Like they
exactly.
Just, they won't, which is weird because I'm like, dude, you guys would make a killing.
Especially Communication Breakdown, not a common, totally common Led Zeppelin song.
The actual one, the original track was actually played in the movie, but if you bought the soundtrack, somebody remixed it.
Sounds like shit.
It does, just like the, I think it was the Fugees, or it may have been just Wyclef Jean's version of Another One Bites the Dust.
Yeah.
And then somebody remixed Tom Sawyer on that one.
Yeah.
But yeah, Led Zeppelin's like, well, still to this day, even to this recording, I mean, they'll license Rock and Roll to fucking the Cadillac to do a Cadillac commercial, but it's hard. They don't. I don't know if it's they're just touchy about it or like, I know what scene you're going to use this in and I just don't like it. But yeah, they're still to this day. And that's really Guns N' Roses is like that too. The fact that Paradise City got in Can't Hardly Wait.
Yeah. That's on the soundtrack too.
Yeah, that baffles me. I'm like, you fucking, because they went to court over that. It was Duff, Slash, and
Izzy probably.
I think it was would Matt Storm do it? Even though he was
no.
But they took Axl to court. They're like, dude, we're missing out on like not only promotion, but like fucking, they're gonna pay. They're gonna cut us a check to use the song. And Axl's like, I'm no. So and they released a bunch of titles that like. Music supervisors went up to him and said, hey, can we use a song that they got denied for Black Hawk Down, which is funny because there's a scene in Black Hawk Down right before they get in the helicopter and go where they're going. Another Ridley Scott movie. And they play Falling to Pieces from Faith No More.
Yeah.
And I think they originally was going to use Welcome to the Jungle, if I'm not mistaken. But yeah, a Guns N' Roses song. And I want to say, Gross Point Blank's another one. They used their cover of Live and Let Die, and that was a John Cusack dark romantic comedy thing. So, and I kind of touched on that in the last one about 90s comedies. But so, yeah, soundtrack's pretty solid. It needs a vinyl reissue. Like FYE or Waxworks needs to get on that and just be like, hey, especially with Lenny.
Honestly.
And we're back on. We had another technical difficulty because I want to be mobile, and I realize this thing sucks a lot of battery life.
Hey, that's all right. Right off the rip, I do have a question for you. And this is a very serious question, and your answer will be judged and overanalyzed by millions of people.
Anything I say on this podcast probably gets scrutinized.
So here it is. Which side did you take, Halen or Roth?
Ooh, wow. Man. See.
And I'm going to need a very detailed explanation as to what your answer is.
Well, what about the Gary Cherone era? Because that was the first time I ever saw Van Halen.
That counts as Halen, so.
So that counts as Halen? It's, you know, when I get asked that, or which isn't very often, and good question, by the way. You've just been just a wonderful host. I can't wait to have you back on future episodes. For me, I divide Van Halen into like three eras. You got the Roth era, and you know those all, you know, the riffs and the just the anthems, and you know they're all bangers. Van Halen never did a bad record. I'm talking about.
I agree.
You know, even three was good, but you know that's.
I've never heard a Van Halen song and said, "This is bad."
There's some I listen to, like the.
But there's songs that I don't listen to more than others. But never have I heard I've never heard Eddie Van Halen play on any recorded audio anything and been like, this is bad.
There's Van Halen's obviously my favorite band of all time. I can safely say that. I mean, they outrank, you know, Rush and Mastodon, and those are my top three. And Van Halen's also a band that, like, you'll overlook an album. And I've done this recently. I'm not a huge Balance guy. I thought that was a weak exit for Hagar, especially coming off the...
Got some good cuts on that, though.
Especially coming off the... I do agree, and I'm getting to one. Especially coming off the Fuck album.
Yeah.
And that album gets overlooked because, you know, the 90s came. Metal kind of went underground. Seattle took over. I don't like to say grunge. It's like the guy, Stone Gossard, said, he's like, that's more like a fashion statement. That's not a thing.
Yeah.
And then you had people like, you had bands like Aerosmith, Van Halen. I'll even throw Meatloaf into this, that were doing really awesome records. And Aerosmith and Meatloaf kind of just, you know, skyrocketed again. I mean, Aerosmith.
They reinvented their careers in the third decade, yeah.
Aerosmith had three, like resurrections. They had it in the 80s with Permanent Vacation. They had it with Get a Grip. And I'll even go as far as to say Nine Lives and the space rock movie they did the song for. But that, the for Unlawful Carnal Knowledge, gets just lost in the mix. Revenge does too, from Kiss.
Yeah, you're right.
And there was,
that's an era where people were trying to adapt, and they did. Those are great records. These are great records to listen to,
yeah.
But everyone overlooks them because of the massive crater of Seattle and everything else that was going on with music at the time.
And, you know, Kiss definitely had a makeover with Revenge. They were a heavy band because for years they were just kind of like, how do you describe from Lick It Up to Hot in the Shade? Hot in the Shade, you could tell they were going to go back into a heavier direction.
Dayglow.
The Dayglow Kiss era.
The Dayglow Kiss era, which I love, and I'll put up to bat for a lot of songs during that era. Like, I will put that era of Kiss up against a lot of bands' talent and songwriting in the same class. Like, it's up there. But regardless, Halen or Roth,
okay,
dude, who are you taking?
Okay, but like I said, that album got lost in the shuffle. It brought Van Halen back to almost the 70s era.
I'm talking like Halen.
Yeah, but I was
or talking. Roth.
But
split right there, 1983, 1984.
Yeah,
who are you taking?
Like I said, I see them as two different bands, though. Like, you know, like I said earlier, you had Roth with all the with the anthems, you know, the riffs, and then you got like the heart with Hagar. There was more like, I mean, there was soul with Roth, but like, I mean, with Hagar, you were doing ballads and, you know, softer stuff, and it's hard. It's hard for me to choose. I see them as two different bands. I mean, it's Van Halen at the end of the day, but it's really hard to choose because I see them as two different bands. You know, you got kind of, like I said, the ballads with Hagar and stuff. And some of the stuff with Hagar that he did, I like it, but I wasn't too crazy. Like, OU812 is a soft fucking record. I mean, there's some good bangers on it, like Mine All Mine and Sucker in a Three-Piece. And then, you know, they went back.
Feel So Good.
Feel So Good to Go. I mean, the ballads they did on that was great, but I think they went so far with the ballads they did on 5150, like, Why Can't This Be Love, Dreams, and Love Walks In. They're like, well, why don't we just make a whole record of that? And for me, Van Halen's all about the riff. The riff and Alex, like, for me, that at the end of the day, it's just those guys. And, you know, I can't discredit Michael Anthony or even Wolfgang Van Halen for that factor. And with OU812, that just kind of got lost. There was more keyboards and stuff. I mean, there was some inventive stuff Eddie did guitar-wise. But that just with that, and then they did Fuck, and that was just a heavy record. Nobody ever says that about that. Balance, it's kind of 50-50, but I'll tell you, the one track I am that is forcing me to go revisit that record is Amsterdam.
Yeah.
Because they had the video on YouTube of him playing it like 10 years before they recorded it. I was like, dude, that riff's fucking just, what are you doing here, man? Like, this is great. And that's a band you definitely go back and revisit stuff if you hear something that, you know, catches your eye. But ultimately, I can't choose because I see them as two different bands. Like, you know.
So this is what I'm thinking, like, out loud right now,
mm-hmm.
in this moment. Van Halen and Roth split. You either go with David Lee Roth, like you go with him and his career, or you go with Van Halen and their career. So what I'm thinking right now, judging by your words just now, you're following Van Halen.
I'm going to have... Oh, man, that's...
Yeah, dude, no, listen, you're going to have to. So, I mean... David Lee Roth is one of one, you know? Like, I love him.
He's
I loved
performer.
His solo stuff. He is such a personality and a genius and an innovator of his own mind. Like, he knows everything about it. And it's heartbreaking that he and Van Halen couldn't work out, but it also makes sense.
Yeah.
Both of those entities, Van Halen and David Lee Roth, are too big for each other. So when Roth split, Roth did his whole thing with Steve Vai and Billy Sheehan and Greg Bissonette, all these great freaking people, had some great songs, but, and that is a huge but, Van Halen managed to pick up their career right where they left it off with Hagar and just shoot above the stratosphere. And now we're talking like a legacy band forever. Like, Dave Lee Roth's solo stuff will never be admired by anybody.
I felt with the solo stuff.
As much as...
Oh, yeah.
5150, OU8, fuck, the Twister soundtrack.
Oh, dude, that... And if we want to get technical, that was the last thing. Well, they did the greatest hit songs.
Yeah, they did. Meet Wise Magic, you know, all those songs.
I was talking about Best of Both Worlds.
Yeah, after that. With the, you know, It's About Time, Hagar. You know. Yeah. That's it. And it speaks volumes of their career that they can still manage. Because Eddie, like David Lee Roth, is one of one. But I feel like Eddie is more sought after and... more irreplaceable than David. David can only do so much. David can only be Dave TV for so long. Eddie is, I mean, that talent is an ever flowing faucet of amazing, and nobody can ever replace that. And Dave Lee Roth passed tomorrow, I'd be just as upset, but
yeah,
Eddie is going to be the guy that reinvented the wheel and is going to live on forever.
Are you upset he never did any more music?
Eddie?
Yeah.
No, because I honestly feel like he did so much and he was still chasing so much. Like, he never just settled.
I chased tone, man. That's what he said.
Yeah, I feel like he was always after something new. He's always after something cool. And Van Halen, I would say, once, like you said, never made a bad record. I totally agree with that. But you think about 70s, 80s, 90s, 2000s, and even the 2010s with... A Different Kind of Truth. Like,
that was,
they
a
made a great record in five different decades. And we're talking like great, like you can put on right now and enjoy it.
I'm literally put on right now.
Right now.
The thing with Roth's solo career that kind of rubbed me the wrong way, I felt like those are great players. I will never take anything away from those guys, especially Steve Vai. Steve Vai used to do music.
Yeah, amazing.
Used to do transcript music for Frank Zappa, and we both know that. Like a high school music
amazing
teacher,
guitar player, amazing musician.
Couldn't do that.
However,
I just felt like when he got those guys, he just wanted to be like, I want to be Van Halen on steroids.
Yeah, totally. And that's why, I mean, some of the songs are great. Be sure, catch me at the bar. I'll play, you know.
Just Like Paradise.
Or,
going crazy.
You know, Shy Boy or whatever, you know. Like
Yankee Rose.
Yankee Rose especially, dude. I'm playing that every 4th of July. But... those songs are only good. I mean, that's it. That's all. That's the longevity of those tunes. And Eddie, his sound, his, you know, ability to adapt, that's actually going to live on forever.
And it's funny because when David would come out with a new record, Eddie would somehow end up on Howard Stern. And, you know, Howard Stern's a fucking shit starter. He's like, what'd you think about Ross' last record? And he was always, like, complimentary. He's like, yeah, it was pretty good, you know. And the one that really stuck out in my mind is the one of the last records David Lee Roth that he did with John Five. And Eddie was on Howard Stern, and he's like, what do you think about David Lee Roth's new one? He's just like, yeah. He's like, it was pretty good. He's like, I don't know who he's got playing guitar for him, but he needs to keep him. That guy's good.
Yeah.
So, and I freaked out when I met John Five. I was like, dude, Van Halen called you good.
Yeah.
And he's like, yeah, I know.
He's like, thanks.
I was
Also, I thought this was funny, is that David Lee Roth released Eat 'Em Up and Smile.
Oh, dude. And then OU812.
And then OU812. Is that correlated, do you think?
It is, because I... whose biography? Oh, it...
Sammy's probably, or...
It was Sammy's, because he's all like, we just did that to kind of make fun of Roth. He's like, we didn't do it enough on the 51... what was that song? Inside. Because I remember playing that when I was a kid, and Dad walked in the room, and Dad's like, you know who's making... They're making fun of David Lee Roth right now. I was like, really? And then I went back and listened to it again, and I was like, oh...
Yeah. So anyway, you're listening to the Van Halen podcast, featuring two brothers who love Van Halen.
Do you remember the first time you heard Van Halen? For me, it's just, it was always around.
I'm definitely willing to tell that story on the Van Halen podcast.
Oh, it was always around.
Yeah, they're always there. I mean, it's you're born with it in your DNA.
I just thought it was really, I was just, one of my favorite memories is us going to the riverbed and seeing them. And
yeah,
we unfortunately didn't know that was going to be the last time we saw them. And that's a lesson I want everybody to take. Besides, I give out a bunch of useless information is, you know, never pass up a concert ticket. As Jamie Josta says, go see these people. Cause you know, I saw Prince and he died nearly a year later. So yeah, never pass it up, man. And speaking of which, I gotta actually, I want Jeff to tell us news. So who am I seeing in May for the first time?
I have convinced Andy here to go see Kiss on their farewell tour.
Yes, he has. I'm
End
going.
Of the road. I said, you know what? We're doing it. They rescheduled a date from Dayton, so I'm glad that we can actually be able to go because he's missing out. I mean, you're missing out on a fun show. Kiss is also one of those bands that's going to be embedded in our DNA forever. We know too much about this band for our own good. Come back later for the Kiss Forum podcast.
Oh, we're definitely going to do one about the Meets the Phantom.
So, yeah. But yeah, we're doing it, dude. We're doing it.
Yeah, I'm stoked about this.
Anything else left you have to say about this fantastic film, Airheads, before we sign off? Besides the fact the Blu-ray is an absurd price because it's out of print. Andy and I are here with the VHS and the DVD copy. Andy has a copy of the Blu-ray. How much did you pay for that?
I paid like $9 for it.
$9 for it. It's currently on eBay literally for $150, $200.
Because 20th Century Fox, no, Anchor Bay did it. And the problem with the Blu-ray is it has none of the special features. I mean, the DVD Jeff has right in front of him has the White Zombie music video, which you can probably find on YouTube. The Motorhead video you can find on YouTube. And there's like a creepy like mockumentary. It's not creepy. I don't know why I said that. I just, there's a mockumentary about like the news footage from the hostage takeover and stuff. It was like a behind this. I saw that on HBO when it premiered.
I'm looking right now at a copy of the Blu-ray, the only copy of the Blu-ray that's on eBay, and it's not even sealed, it's opened. Can you guess the price?
I'm gonna say like $95.
$95. This is a price. It's not, like I said, it's not brand new. It's not sealed. It's open. $339.95. Or best offer.
You laugh at me because I'm not Jeff, because Jeff's
$339 and Andy paid $9 for this brand new.
I either paid $9 or $15. I went on a splurge on Amazon when I lived with Dad and I bought it and I was like, they're gonna reissue it like later. No. My Freddy.
That's the only one that's available on eBay right now. And the DVD is even like $16 used, which I have right in front of me.
I paid like $9 for my copy. That was one of the first DVDs I bought, too, when I started collecting.
So if you want this movie...
Shout Factory, why don't you get on it?
Yeah, really, Shout Factory, Arrow, somebody, Blue Underground, get on this.
Too many.
This is a $1 million. You could make it $50 for this Blu-ray or 4K, 2K restoration, and it would sell like hotcakes.
I'm weird about 4K comedy movies, because I don't know, like, comedies are some of the best movies you ever see shot. Like, take for instance, like Tropic Thunder or like The Hangover. Those are shot really well. This was shot really well, too. And the director of this movie, Michael Lehman, he did Heathers like years before this. And that's another cult classic. It's still a dark movie. Actually, Paramount was going to make a TV show out of it, and then they pulled it.
Yeah. And I believe that.
So. And I thought it was really appropriate for Michael Lehman to do a movie like this. I'm kind of bummed out. I don't think he had too much of a theatrical career after this movie, because back in those days, this movie didn't do well. You know, of course, I remember this movie opened when The Mask opened, because I went to go see Nana took me to go see The Mask, and I remember this was playing in the theater around the same time. The Mask, and I want to say Pocahontas or something was playing, like a Disney movie, because I remember, I think Mom took us to go see the Disney movie, because I want to say I tried to convince her to go take us to go see Airheads, and she wouldn't do it. But it didn't make much money. I think it made its budget back.
Yeah, but that wasn't like
a... wasn't a huge success, which is a shame. But the beauty of comedies, especially in the 90s, that didn't make much money, they had an excellent afterlife on home video and cable. Because like you said earlier, you watched this on cable on the 2 o'clock movie on Comedy Central. You know, stuff like this and PCU just lived on.
I do want to reiterate here... its current score on Rotten Tomatoes. Do you want to guess what it is? The current score on Rotten Tomatoes is a 25%.
That's not good.
Based on 36 reviews from the New York Times, Washington Post, Variety. The site's critical consensus states, there's a biting satire that keeps threatening to burst out of the well-cast Airheads. But unfortunately, the end result lives down to its title in the most unfortunate ways.
I
don't understand. This is a fun movie to watch.
I'm just glad Terry Gilliam didn't review it, because he's I don't know. Yeah. He's still upset that they didn't release his version of Brazil. Or the fact that he can't... I mean, he gets legitimate work, but...
Yeah.
Or like Francis Ford Coppola, who has to re-edit his movies, but yet will bash Marvel movies. I'm like, dude, you survive on wine and fucking re-editing Apocalypse Now for whatever fucking reason. And then you're having the 4K cut of The Godfather come out. Like, just stop where you're head.
Yeah. Anyway, this movie's great. I don't care what Rotten Tomatoes says. If you are, I mean, it's probably streaming somewhere, right? Where's it on right now?
No, it's not streaming anywhere. This
really?
That's the thing. And I can't stress this enough. Like, that's why physical media is important. That's why it's important to go find your favorite movie or a movie you enjoyed a little bit growing up. Because, you know, you can't rely on these streaming services.
Yeah.
A, because it's unavailable, and B, they edit shit. I heard Disney Plus edited like a butt shot out of the movie Splash.
Yeah.
You know, that's why it's so important to go buy this shit.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. What I'm looking at here, if you have the premium Hulu subscription, it's streaming on Hulu Premium only. And also streaming on Amazon Prime if you have the premium subscription.
Oh, I think I did see it. And it's good to see that, because if you haven't seen this movie since it was on cable or on DVD, I mean, it's in HD. And the HD transfer from... on the Anchor Bay one. Anchor Bay's, yeah, their slouch,
it's
was really
with
good.
The Cinemax add-on with Amazon Prime.
I'm just wondering what's going on with the licensing. I'm surprised Shout hasn't picked it up. Kino hasn't picked it up. Mill Creek hasn't picked
Who
it
owns
up.
This movie? 20th Century Fox?
Yeah.
So now Disney owns it, dude. That's going to be hard. That's going to be hard to pull it away from.
Disney's only worried about like what's going to make them money, and rightfully so. They're a money machine.
Yeah, good luck getting a movie out of 20th Century or Disney at this point.
But so. What, and it's like we were talking about Arrow and stuff, what these major studios are doing now, they're trying to like cut out doing physical media manufacturing. So they license their movies out to like Kino, Labor, Arrow. Yeah.
We might have had a good shot before they sold to Disney, but now there's no way.
But that doesn't make it, that to me, that doesn't make any sense, because you can make an extra, you could save money because you're not spending money on manufacturing and, you know, whatever. By selling it to like Mill Creek or something.
Yeah, they're not. Yeah. Disney's pretty stubborn with this kind of stuff.
Well, they're going to keep Star Wars and The Simpsons,
yeah,
by godly, but they're, yeah, mate, I don't get that. Like, every film deserves to be out there. It deserves to be seen. It deserves to be loved. Like, I don't care what movie it is.
Yeah, you're right.
And that's why it's so important to just buy this shit. Don't rely on your streaming service.
Yeah, the point of this whole podcast, buy the shit.
Yeah, buy the shit, man. Like, every movie that I review, except for Licorice Pizza, I don't have that yet because it's not out yet. But if anybody's out there willing to just give me their Oscar screener, I won't upload it to BitTorrent. I'll keep it for myself.
Nice. For your consideration, give this movie.
Please, because that was one of my
to this
favorite.
Guy. Anyway, Airheads, dude. I fucking love this movie.
I fucking love this movie too, man. I'm glad we got to do this, and he will be back. You got the knack for podcasting. I'm learning. I'm learning. I'm just like, it's a big learning curve for me.
Yeah, man. Thanks for having me on, dude.
Well, thank you for doing
this,
man.
Let's talk about another movie that might have sucked to everyone else, but we dig.
Like Joe's Apartment?
Yes.
I have not seen that movie in 20 years. What other one? There's several.
Yeah, there's a lot. We like a lot of shitty movies.
Well, are they shitty, though? I mean...
Yeah, who cares?
We don't go by the Rotten Tomatoes, obviously.
That's right. Anyway, thanks for having me on, dude.
I appreciate it.
Cheers. Here's to the triple threat, Brendan Fraser, Steve Buscemi, and Adam Sandler, and the Lone Rangers. Why would you pluralize the Lone Ranger? And I don't know. And we'll see you next time.
Yeah, and long live KPBX Rebel Radio, which is now probably right now the rain.
The rain on KPBX. The mellow sounds of the rain.
And I would like those rain shirts if anybody has those too.
Hit me up. Anyway, peace out, Radio Land.
Until next time, thank you, Jeff, for being here. Thank you for Manning, dude. I learned so much from having you on, so thank you.
My pleasure, my treasure.
Little Jonah Hill right there, everybody. All right, thank you, everybody. Until next time, bye.